This is the AdNonTech Podcast, conversations about education, technology, and culture, with Dr. Doug Reed and Dr. Matt Stranick. Thank you for joining us.
My name is Dr. Doug Reed, and I am located in Abigwe, the traditional and unceded territory of the Mi'kmaq people.
My name is Dr. Matthew Stranick, and I am located at Manakwisk in St. John, New Brunswick, which is situated on the traditional and unceded territory of the Wolastoqiyik Maliseet people. Welcome to the latest edition of the AdNonTech Podcast. We have the inestimable Dr. Doug Reed with us as ever, and myself, Matt Stranick. Really pleased to see you here. I hope everybody's enjoying the early days of summer, such as they've been so far. Doug, how are you making out with these early, hazy, lazy, crazy days of whatchamacallit?
I'm really enjoying the weather that we've had lately because it's been raining pretty nonstop. So that means I don't have to mow and I don't have to weed the garden. So it's fantastic.
So much time and energy to devote to other pursuits, would I dare say, indoor activities of various sorts, or is it more just chillaxing properly, sir?
It was yesterday was a lot of sitting and reading because I've been missing like reading a novel. I've been reading for like this, right? It's like, let's read a bunch of articles to try to find nuggets. So it was really nice. And then I took my dog for a walk. They got so dirty. Now my whole house is gritty. So I now know what I do today. Give the dogs a bath and clean everything.
You know, having dogs, like, are, it's really, my mom has even told me this. She's raised dogs and she's raised children. It's like the same level of mess and chaos and care that's needed pretty much as a human toddler, right? Basically, like, fully verbal, you know, mostly knows where to use the bathroom, but not always. It's not dissimilar, man. Well, that's... Yeah. That's radical, bro. So you told me you were pretty stoked about this particular topic, and I'm going to be legit here in that I'm just looking at the notes for the first time, but that doesn't diminish or otherwise mitigate my interest here, because when I read this title in the Word document, I started thinking, postmodernism, perchance. Do I know enough about Foucault? Do I know enough about Diderot or, you know, thereabouts, right? I mean, these sort of adjacent people. You start talking structure, post-structure, and there's this whole area of discourse, which I know sort of on the face of it to sort of say, okay, this reminds me of some things, but I'd be really interested to know where you were coming from with it, sir.
Sure. So what I've titled this is Leveraging Structures in Education, because I went back and forth on about four different titles, and it's like, why? Let's just pick one and move. We're going to talk about what we talk about. So in a previous episode, we talked, like, how did we get here? One of those kind of conversations, and we had Pressy's first ed tech device and all that history. And I really wanted to dig into what assumptions have we made, what boxes have we created for ourselves that are imaginary and in our heads, and suddenly they become rules, and why? And Can they change? Do they need to change? And I just wanted to have that conversation with you because I love your insights on these sorts of things because you always take it in a different direction that I find really enjoyable.
Well, I appreciate that, bro. Thank you. And appreciate the delineation here. Certainly the difference in perspectives, you know, we got this kind of overlapping in that we're middle-aged, super educated, what do you call it, Atlantic Canadian white guys, basically, for no other, for want of another term. But it's really the differences, right? Again, it's sort of the Venn diagram is how this podcast shows up, the center point, and then it's the outer, you know, stuff outside that you can sort of draw into it that to me is kind of interesting and dynamic. And that's kind of what's cool about any creative endeavor, as I've been experiencing with these podcasts lately and even the interviews, right? So everybody's got like this creative thing that they do in some way or other. And it's just been really, I don't know. I think what you've come up with here for a topic is in keeping with the similar, you know, the trajectory of the show and particularly vis-a-vis some of these interviews. So that's awesome, Matt. So we got here Wahlberg from 1967. What do you got to say about that, Brent?
So just before we get there,
sure.
I have some questions that were in my head. I don't expect us to get answers. But right. Some of my questions were, how did we get here? Like I've taught at I worked at several different post-secondaries, mm-hmm. and semesters are, what, 12 weeks long, 13 weeks long, 15 weeks long, 16 weeks long, 39 hours, 45 hours. Who made that up? Like, how did we determine what that was? And how come in North America there's two semesters and then the other stuff that gets squeezed in? Because I had a friend working in the UK, and they had three full semesters. So they never had empty buildings, right? They didn't have a couple of months of nothing going on. And I'm just wondering, how did we end up here? And then I dug into that a little more because I can't help myself. And I wanted to dig into that stuff. And other than like Paulo Freire, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, the structural components were missing this week. So I don't know if I was using the wrong terms.
Oh, no, man. That's awesome. So you're talking structural as in facilities, like buildings.
Not even. I'm talking like infrastructure. Like, why does semester start September 1? Or maybe it doesn't. Why does school end on June 30th? Because I know some places June ends on June 1st.
Organizational and institutional norms, arbitrary holdovers from whatever remnants of a pre-industrial academic culture, Euro culture, let's be clear, that it emerged from, sure, with all the colonial baggage that comes along with that from you know, the perspective of basically anybody that isn't white European. So, nah, man, that's legit. That's very cool. So, again, I think that's sort of I think there's a lot of places we could go with this, and I think you've really hit on a compelling I don't know if gap is necessarily what we're going to call that this, but certainly an area that warrants further exploration vis-a-vis the resources that we can draw to it through our conversation here, pal, because that's what we do. So yeah. That's rad, man. Highly legit, bro. So, anything further before we speak to Wahlberg here?
Nope.
Yeah, man.
So with Wahlberg, because it's 1967, he went back, and as soon as he starts talking about Socrates and Hemlock and exile and all that stuff, and that was a societal structural decision on Socrates, right? He was ruining the youth or influencing the youth of Athens or whatever the label was that he had. And he had a choice between like shutting up and going away or killing himself with hemlock. And he chose the hemlock because that was the structure. That was his understanding on, well, I walk the walk, I need to talk the talk, and or vice versa. Sorry, talk the talk and then walk the walk. And so when I started digging into that, it's like, okay, so this is a couple of thousand years old. This is, I am not the first person to fall into this rabbit hole and see where it goes. But there was this cool little diagram that Wahlberg talked about, and I included it in the notes. And somebody has taken the paper version of this, scanned it, and posted it online. Like, this is not a, this was not typed just for this. But when I looked at this list, they talk about institution, role, expectations, class, climate, intentions, behavior, individual personality, dispositions. Where's society in that? Like, where is the, like, is institution the part that, that covers that whole big picture of why are we doing what we're doing, how we're doing it, or where are we coming from? So he, so Wahlberg, I assume it was a guy because it is 1967. So apologies to any women out there. That's not where I'm headed. I'm just repeating the past. It's, didn't even think about it. So was this, did he ignore it on purpose? Or was this just an invisible box and he didn't notice that that's just the way society was before we started to think more about it? So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on, because as soon as he said philosophical and literary traditions, I know you know a lot more about literary traditions than I do, right? You, your brain works that way and you've dug into that before.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, I mean, I think you've sort of, I think you're right that this sort of is an interesting sort of case of perhaps, what do you call it, implicit bias on the part of the author at the time, and probably in as much as the, you know, journal in question, the article, the reference, whatever, went through what must have been fairly rigorous peer review. At the time, one can assume that such implicit bias likely does speak to a wider, you know, set of a priori assumptions, if you will, within the academic endeavor which produced it. So, nah, man, I appreciate, you know, the reference to Socrates. Okay, you ever seen Bill and Ted?
Excellent. Many times, many
okay,
times.
So part two, right? Part two is when they go and basically hijack or kidnap historical figures, and Socrates is the correct spelling, or pronunciation, sorry.
Yes.
It's the same spelling, but it's Socrates. So that was really, I really wanted to make sure I expressed that. But in truth, though, I guess public participation vis-a-vis committing yourself to a social enterprise is a pretty fundamental aspect of human endeavor, I want to say, since we, you know, have any kind of recorded history. So, yeah, man, it's legit. I think this is I think this is cool. So, yeah, man.
I want to tie Socrates' choice to conversations I've had with people about online learning and blended learning, because
awesome.
I've had these conversations. I have a very wide, broad definition of online and blended learning, and I don't have the barriers that some people have, because I've talked to people and they're like, oh, I'm going to teach online. It's like, okay, so I need a learning management system. And I need a question bank for the multiple choices so the computer can mark it. And I need a video feed so that we can do this many hours of face-to-face. Plus, I'm going to record myself. And it's like, oh, that is a horrible recipe. It's, you are 100% ignoring the students. And all you're doing to design it are, here's are the tools. Here's where we're headed. But people have it stuck in their head. This is what it is. This is what online learning is. This is what blended is. And it's like, ugh. No, let's widen that a little bit. Maybe Socrates could have had another choice, right? I'm not going to second guess him. But that's what people have when you talk about the individual group relations, right? It's like, okay, So my relationship with other educators and other society members is going to impact what I do or not, right? Depending on my life and my path that I've taken. I wouldn't want anybody else to follow my footsteps and go on the same journey I've gone on, but it's how is the group relations coming to the individual is what I'm really trying to dig into.
No, man, everything you're saying really lands for me. I guess, I don't know, it's funny, the notion of, I'm thinking of conformity and non-conformity, and I suppose that sort of is in keeping a bit with the postmodern sort of tip that I find what you're describing on here. Because the presumed, you know, the Socratic method, right, sort of following questions with more questions is sort of foundational to how we carry out the educational endeavor. And you could say, well, I mean, it's not like that's where we have to lay blame for, you know, what you were talking about earlier, you know, like the arbitrary scheduling of the academic year or all of the accoutrements and issues that have emerged as this foundation has sort of built up into this towering edifice, if you will. So when Socrates was sort of rocking it in the Agora back in Athens back in the day, I mean, the whole, you know, he was really just, what do you see around you? You know, he always, the take it back to your basic assumptions. That is what you could arguably say is one of the valuable aspects of the Western approach to education, if you want to say that. Not knowing, wanting to know, that's how Frank Cronin, a really awesome prof at St. Thomas, put it, who I had when I was doing my philosophy minor as part of my Bachelor of Education roughly 20 years ago. 30, good Lord. I tried to cheat myself out of a decade. So, I think just to wind it down in terms of these kind of ramblings that I would put forward here, it really comes down to just people having the courage of their convictions, and contemporary education has just sort of pinned so much in post-secondary for sure, on a consumer model, right? You pay this much, you achieve, you know, these kind of scores, you get to go to X, Y, or Z institution and have X, Y, or Z kind of life sort of largely kind of handed to you afterwards if you're willing to put in the work and basic social conventions. It's really just the consumerization of education generally is, I think, kind of something we're going to be speaking to a little bit more as we go forward with this book.
Yeah.
Sorry, again, kind of a tangent there, but
not at all, because part of what I was trying to get to, you've touched on, because how much of education, especially in classrooms, and I'm going to go to the Ames 1992 article, Classrooms, Goal Structure, sure. Student Motivation.
Yep.
And one thing that I remember when I was an elementary school teacher was the difference between girls and boys, right? Girls, elementary school seemed to be set up for women, right? Girls went along better, so they were the better kids. And boys were the more rambunctious and more in trouble all the time. And I'm grossly over-exaggerating this, but that's the structure, and the research backs us up on that, right? That it's, that's how things work. It's going along to get along. And have we wandered down a path as a society and in institutional structures to really miss opportunities here? Right? Because classroom and other learning environments have been described in terms of kinds of instructional demands, situational constraints, and psychosocial characteristics. And
that's good. I like that. Psychosocial characteristics. That's a key. That's a pretty strong factor in my experience as a student in a lot of classrooms, both in person and otherwise, and a teacher in classrooms, both in person and otherwise. And as, again, somebody who did like their, doctoral thesis on a thing called social presence in online courses, I think that that is a pretty strong component of, I don't know, anything that to do with online education, because when we're talking about, you know, community of inquiry model, a great deal of that early research and what part of the reason why that research was so valuable is because it addressed text-based communication, largely discussion board, largely LMS. Let's be real. It was the early internet we're talking about. But what it does is it sort of it speaks to the need of because you're limited to text and possibly some image communication, you have to take additional steps to bring the online psycho and social elements that are crucial for learning up. So if you look at it, to speak to your earlier point, in terms of like, well, I got these tools and these sets of activities in the LMS to slot these, you know, students, these FTEs into through the LMS. It's like, you know, again, that's kind of, that's putting the cart well before the horse by about a mile, a country mile, God, is what that is. And so it's just sort of, you know, thinking about it in terms of what is the overall, you know, you have to elevate what you do socially online to get anywhere close to the same natural kind of one-to-one engagement that you get in various ways in a blended and or in-person environment, especially in person. So I totally sort of see the gist of that. If there wasn't, if that, again, that isn't too much of like an abstract or departure or whatever, bro.
No, because I would take that another step.
Okay.
I don't know if you've ever had to be in one of those big lecture auditoriums and teach a class there.
I've enjoyed that. The very few times that I've had a chance to speak in that kind of setting, I've enjoyed that a lot, actually. But
you had a very different set of skills needed based on one-on-one or based on teaching online with your text presence to in a small classroom to that, right? Like, that is a whole different set of skills going on. And those connections that you make are absolutely going to be different.
Absolutely. I quite agree, pal.
And one of the structures that I found interesting was I was at an institution and they were building a new building. And there was this big presentation. The architects had finished this, whatever. They were doing their presentation on here's what it's going to look like. And then somebody said, how many people can fit in those classrooms? And they're like, oh, yeah, we built it for these ones are 60 students and these are 75 students. And somebody at the back was like, we don't have classes that size. I'm like, what do you mean? Everybody has classes that size. No, we don't. Our classes cap at 40. We need classes that are small. We need 25s or we need 40s. We do not need 60 and 75. Can we get more classes instead? And it was that depth of conversation. It was that detail to say, yeah, we don't do that. Maybe that happens at other places, but not here. And it was looking at the infrastructure, because I've been in those rooms, like even at a conference. You go to a conference and you're the last one on Friday afternoon presenting, and there's three other people in the room. And one of them's the moderator and one's the other presenter. And then there's the one token person hanging around because they have a late flight, whatever reason it is. So it's just the echoes of I did all this work and I'm talking to nobody. So it's taking a look at what's the infrastructure and how is that impacting us and why does this need to be the way it is. I just keep coming back to that.
Oh, it's really weird.
Yeah, I knew this was a different topic, because I was digging in and there was just like, I didn't have a firm handle on it. This is like a much more jump around and investigate. Let's have a, I don't know. I'm still working through it in my head. It's one of those things.
Okay. Fair enough. No, man, it's, again, I really appreciate, that you've sort of found something that to my mind, it's got a lot of question marks around it. It's one of those ill-defined problems. It's one of those, wicked problems, which they use sometimes in the business study literature as a term, or, in the educational futures sort of sector that I've heard. And again, that kind of puts me into the, if you're trying to, you know, figure something out, then the process of figuring it out is a lot of your reward, right? It's a lot of like, well, you know, it adds neuroplasticity. It keeps, you know, it's like doing Rubik's Cube or needlework or whatnot. It's just like, so you start with something that's very ill-defined, and that just sort of trying to put a parameter on it causes you to make certain choices and execute in such a manner that, hopefully has value beyond the current moment, right? I spoke with Stephen Downs, I mean, he really is all about the cognitive function of education. It's really like, if you look at it, you know, from strictly a physical standpoint, it's about the creation of new neural connections vis-a-vis stimuli. So, again, here, bro, I don't know if any of that lands in terms of what you're thinking is here, but that's just kind of what you put me in the mentality of here, pal.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it because you helped figure out that what I'm doing right now is where my bias is. It's social constructionism, right? Yeah. It's come up with something, do some investigation, then talk, create knowledge on the fly.
Apologies, bro. That's gonna make for a wicked Camtasia point edit. I like throwing those little gifs. I don't know if you ever watch some of these videos. It's like when there's a Camtasia edit, I get to do a little segue or whatever. But again, I appreciate the valuable comments you were just making, Doug. Could you please restate it? In as much as we just came back from a pretty lit Camtasia edit.
Yeah. Okay. Briefly, I'm a social constructionist. I make no bones about that. And when you were delving into what you were saying, it was like, oh wow, that's what I'm doing. I'm doing it right now. And it was just one of those aha moments that, oh, I'm being a social constructionist. I did some reading, interacting with a valued peer, and I'm creating my knowledge as I go, and the learning artifact, again, is going to be the notes in this podcast. So while that was not my goal, that is not what the topic was, it was, yep, here's my bias, here's where I fell into, because I've done enough reading to say, yeah, this is how I learn best. This works for me. So thank you for your comments on that to bring me to that revelation.
Revelation Incorporated. It's Sunday. Praise the deity or non-deity of your choice. Bro, I'm feeling the abstraction. I'm feeling the questions behind the questions that inform our further and past questions. And I'm wearing even a post-structuralist shirt, right? Everything falls apart. This is a hardcore band from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Whisker Du, legendary. I got one of their tattoos. And I figured out just sort of as I was perusing these notes in advance of our chat, I always, for me, I don't sit well. I don't feel comfortable until you give me like what we're about and, you know, sort of the proper title. But until I can kind of slot it into my, I need the musical selection because that will be the title. And therefore, from there, a theme, and from therefore, a visual schema, if you will, to inform the media elements in true social constructionist fashion, as we've come to express through not just practice, but through theory, as well as artifacts, you know. And so the name of the episode is going to be 8 Miles High, because I think that has to do with structure. And this is from the single. It's by Husker Du. They're covering a song from the 60s by the Byrds. 8 Miles High. 80s. So we're talking 80s hardcore pioneer punks playing a cover of a psychedelic 60s nugget by the Byrds. And so hence, you know, the Byrds, because this is like from the cover of that single. Folks,
I've heard of the Byrds,
and yet you got it. So there you go. There you go, Doug. Academic-ish aspect of this. And yet, sir, and yet.
So that makes me feel better, because it's the borrowing from the past to make it newer, and here's the structure, and here's how we're going. So it's another example for me. I want to jump into the Van Den Oord and Van Rossum 2002 article that I found. And they're talking about the role of characteristics and social structure in the group. And they keep talking about how social adjustment is likely to be influenced by a wide variety of factors. And what are the are we looking at all the factors when we dig in? Or is the structure of post-secondary and academic publishing now so thin sliced that we don't get to look at all the different factors? Because why can't we do some data collection and then, instead of publishing one great article that's nice and deep and everything's there, it's like, go read my 9 articles where this one talked about this factor, this one talked about that factor, this one talked about the other factor. And it's like, I understand why we're doing it. I know what the infrastructure is behind it. I don't like it. I firmly don't like it.
You're speaking of publish or perish. You're speaking of and it's very much, you're hired to teach. You're hired to do research. We really, 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 really value the research. We pay more to researchers. There's more prestige associated with researchers and research initiatives, shirt grants and the like. I mean, again, I've been out of the loop for a while, man. And even just like what you were sort of describing about that whole, you know, going to an academic conference and spending the days full of sessions. And man, I feel so removed from that now. And I just think like the urgency about it. And I just like it's, I understand people need to like sort of get together and chat and stuff. But I just think, man, there's so much resources that goes into that. There's so much like catering. And that's why, let's be clear. I mean, I love going to conferences because I'm like, food budget, hospitality budget, get to talk about my nerd things to my top nerd people from all over the world in my, you know, and everyone thinks I'm smart and everyone like, it's just, come on, man. It's like, I like it too. I do enjoy it too. And I've gone to some rad conferences, Europe, United States, Asia. I mean, it's, I know it and I get it, but just my standpoint on it now in like a post-COVID, you know, recession almost-ish kind of economy, whatever it is now that we're in. It's just, I don't know, man, like a bunch of academics getting together, eating hospitality and travel budget to talk about their stuff. It's just, like what's even the benefit of that? Because I think like the online conference model is actually perfectly serviceable for about 75 to 80%, unless your job relies on physical demonstrations of shit because that's your discipline. I mean, really, just yeah. Anyway, bro, tangents. I got them. It's not just sour grapes because I'm not an academic lately either, I don't think.
No, but you're still active, right? We're doing this, and you're reaching out, and you're having those good conversations with people. And I know at conferences, I always got told, oh, it's the networking. It's the people you talk to at the coffee break. It's the people you talk to at lunch. And it's like...
Story of just like,
yeah.
I got no mental or emotional space for it. I mean, again, if I like attention person who's considering me for a job right now and is doing a reference check on me, because that's where I'm at, I will be happy to represent your institution in any way and capacity. I just think, generally speaking, it's one of those tropes of academia, Doug, to tie it into something a bit more relevant. It's one of those things where, you know, it's like, why are we doing things this way? Like, why are we just sort of like holding on to this industrial kind of era? Like, well, you know, we need the kids in the schools at certain periods of time, and then they need to be available for farming, or, you know, we got to pack them into these, you know, rooms, keep them off the street so the parents can work. I mean, it's, and, yes. And it's just, you know, we're living in a different kind of economic model now, for one thing. People have different work and life patterns drastically than they did in the mid-1800s. When that stuff was first, you know, really, when mass education as we know it sort of started to come to the forefront. I don't know, man. It's a box full of snakes and weasels and badgers, too, while we're at it.
Yeah, and I opened the box.
You did! So, well done, bro.
One of the reasons why I picked this Van Oort and Van Rossum article is... It was a nice article to read. They had done their work. I always find it interesting when people from that part of Europe write, because they have certain ways about them, which I find interesting in small amounts. But one thing they looked at is like, we estimated the importance of individual class and school structures. And it's like, okay, there's more factors than that. So did you just ignore those other ones, or is this one sentence? Did I cherry pick this sentence out? Because as I read through the article, no, I think they left stuff out, and I completely understand why. They could get this published. So that's why they structured it the way they structured it. But it was very typical of about 40 articles I read.
Thin slicing. Again, like, 4 conference papers and 2 or 3 peer-reviewed journals off one initiative. And no, knowledge sharing is an important aspect of the academic endeavor, to be sure. Yeah. But implicit bias we talked about this before. I mean, in the show, it's just like where you just sort of conveniently ask questions that are going to get the most advantageous answers to reach your intended audience rather than best represent your participants in your study, say, or bringing the knowledge forward, you know, as such. It's really, how do I get this thing through peer review, how do I get it into the highest impact journal possible so as to continue my funding and ensure that my yearly report to my chair and or director is sufficiently loaded to keep us looking like we know what we're doing in this academic unit, is basically the sort of unwound version of how this stuff tends to go, Doug. So I appreciate your kind of teasing that out as kind of a flaw, a perhaps implicit flaw within the current way of publishing and sharing and otherwise disseminating. So, yeah, InfoMan.
That reminds me, I had an interview at University of Victoria years ago, and I did the interview, and then I was doing that the chat around where, oh, you have half an hour to meet with this person, half an hour to meet with that person, so they all kind of get to know you a little bit. And one person said, okay, here's the deal. Here's how our structure is at University of Victoria. If you get hired, we're going to offer you this. And that's it. And then every year you don't get an annual a raise. What happens is we compare you to everybody else. And we base how much money we have on how you compare to everybody else.
Ah, they do it on the curve. So that means that there's always somebody who's going to be kind of on the outer end of it, and it's supposed to encourage negative competition. That's like Glengarry getting Glenn Ross. Have you ever seen Glengarry from Glenn Ross?
Oh, years
Alec
ago.
Baldwin's finest performance in a screenplay by David Mamet. Good Lord, man. Do yourself a favor. Classic film adaptation. It's about these hard done by sales guys, and they're the most miserable sons of bitches in the world. And they're in this room together. It's a one act play. Ed Harris is in that, for God's sake, as well as Alec Baldwin. And they have to make a sale of like hotel property that night, or else, you know, so someone's going to lose their job. Anyone who doesn't make a sale that night is going to lose their job. And that is like, and Baldwin just plays this pathological, like, he came from uptown because you guys don't know what the fuck you're doing. You know, it's sort of that mentality, right? Like, we're going to, you know, throw you in a bag with a snake, a monkey, and a dog, and the three, and whoever comes out, you know, the least dead is going to, you know, de facto get the salary increment. Sorry, bro. That was tangential beyond tangential.
But it wasn't. It typified. So the instant he told me that, he said, here's the deal. He goes, if you're the person offered the job, I want you to know this up front, because I do not want to waste my time talking to a whole bunch of people to find out, then tell them this, and then have them say no. I'm giving you all the info up front. Here's how the structure is here. Here's how
you think, eh?
And it's like, and then other people, the next person I talked to was not that person. And I'm like, was this guy putting me on? Is this really how it is here? And they're like, oh yeah, it's horrible. It's horrible because we have two bright shining stars in this faculty that get all the money. And everybody else is screwed, and everybody else hates them. And they're nice enough people, but they don't have lives, and they do 100 hours a week, and they have the network connections, and that's their whole life. They don't have a family. They have nothing but this. So everybody else gets screwed because they take it all. And it's like, how is that a happy? And it's like, oh, we're not here for happy.
So then you do have to ask, so what kind of place is setting it up in such a manner? I've worked in a situation where there was a bright and shiny star, and friends, I was in a situation where I was like, not even the opposite of that. I was like, you know, just this weird kind of outer dwarf kind of thing, kind of flying through the solar system on the way to somewhere else. And, but that star is still shining bright. And, you know, best of luck to everybody, because really, life is too short to carry any kind of negative thing on it. But I know what you mean about that kind of environment, and I guess you probably dodged a bullet. You didn't end up working there, did you, Doug? I mean,
No. I don't think I could control my face well enough. Like, when they said, oh, yeah, no, that's real, that's how it is, it's like, oh. Right, I've worked at bad places, and I was like, "Oh, I don't know if I have the strength to do this, because I already had a job. This was me just saying, oh, this could be better. The grass could be greener, and the grass was not greener. It just wasn't.
I'll tell you, it's my kitchen, my years in the hospitality industry. I worked in restaurants, starting McDonald's when I was 15, and intermittently until almost I was 30, you know, when I worked my last restaurant job. But it was always back of the house, you know, like it was always dish pit, line cook, whatever. I did like one kind of thing for waitering at the Fredericton Boyce Farmers Market, you know, just what that was like one Saturday, you know, that was it. That was the whole thing. But it was always just like, you know, the people who go out front of the house, if you have, it's like you have to, or people who do retail professionally, right, for a long time, that would be beneficial in the kind of situation, because what they're looking for in that kind of situation is somebody who can, well, it's just utterly lovely. It's utterly, you know, it's just, I've been told by people in my life, I mean, you must have been told by people in your life, Doug. I mean, it's just like, can't you just, like, be, it's like, no, I fucking can't, okay? I just fucking can't. It's just my, I can't sort of, and so when I've been out of sync, it's like, that guy's off, and it's like, yeah, I'm not good at pretending that I'm not when I am, right? And it's been to my own detriment. So some people got that, man. Other people clearly do not.
That's exactly it.
Anyway, bro, are we on to Sui and Tio yet? Or
Bergman at
or
all.
Or Bergman and Lufnegger.
And Jostel and Schober. And
at Al. Bergman at Al. There we go.
Yes, that's why I said at Al. This is a 2013 article, The Role of Classroom Structure in Fostering Students' School Functioning. And one thing they dug into is, again, they said, here's four aspects of students' functioning. And they talk about motivation, which, of course, we talked about that, how to engage the students. Self-regulated learning. Yeah, we're lifelong learners. We do that, right? If we're responsible for our stuff. Academic achievement. Yep, there's got to be grades associated there somehow. Are you good enough? Yes, no. And then social functioning. And I think we just touched upon social functioning here a little bit.
Everything we do is within that context, Doug. I mean, what you spoke to earlier about explicitly sort of through practice vis-a-vis this podcast being somewhat of a social constructionist. And I mean, I did my doctorate on the community of inquiry, which is a socially constructivist paradigm in the first place. And then the social element of the community of inquiry specifically. So that's like even more social stacked on top of social in terms of just, you know, the phenomenon or whatnot. So, I mean, everything we do in this show is philosophically and in execution informed by that consideration, right? Because, you know, how do you reach out to people you don't know, to an audience potentially of in the, you know, low dozens, if we're giving ourselves a lot of credit, or, you know, 100 plus, typically what these videos tend to click at. I don't know about, you know, the audio particularly. I don't look at the analytics for that. But it's like, how do you build in that engagement? How do you make it so that people want to come back? Well, I mean, friggin' just be yourself, man, for starters. And importantly, know what you're doing, which, it's kind of hit and miss, but we do what we can, right? So.
And a part of all this, when they talk about their four aspects of student functioning, where is the whole component of here's how the school structure works? Right? Or is that just embedded in all of those things? There's no investigation into, would they work better at a year-round school? Would they work better with an individual tutor? Would they work better with only coming in the mornings and then in the afternoons going to the community college or the vocational training, or like, where is that structure in place? Or when I was in Australia, I was blown away, right? They didn't really have Christmas concerts when I was there because that was summertime, right? December and January, the students were off because that was their summer. So why did that make the flip? So it's not September 1st the most important date. It's not June 30th the most important date. It's when it's warmest out. Is that? Or, like, and that investigation seems incomplete right now. That's just really where I'm headed with all this. And why is it so invisible? Is it just embedded? Have we built glass walls? I know I build glass walls around things because I know I need to be the person that can control my face and be smileier in meetings and not just say, like, have the "are you freaking kidding me" look when certain people say stuff, because that's just not how the structure works. But
I think you're supposed to be able to kind of hold it in until you get tenure. And then after you get tenure, you can just turn into a troll, actually. That's seems to be how it goes. But again, man, I just, I thought for sure at a certain point, I'm like, I'm going to be a post-secondary for my whole thing. And I've been where it's going now could land there. But I mean, so I encourage anybody listening to this, whatever situation you're in terms of your career, whatever your situation you're in terms of, you know, training or personal growth, I mean, there's always more you can be doing. And this means, you know, just following up on just curiosities, right? When I was speaking with John Dron, one of the things that I enjoyed about that chat is he just really was big on unthinking, unlearning. He was like, just pick up something around you that you kind of think is cool and just spend some time with it. He spent 10 years as a professional singer, you know, before getting into his very, very highly regarded, you know, career as a as an educator in the distance and online space. So, yeah, man, I mean, I just I think just sort of the room, the space for informal learning is increasing because of the affordances of online, the regimented somewhat approach to teaching and learning vis-a-vis certain sorts of physical and temporal, you know, structures and curricular sort of dependencies is sort of in question and in flux. And if I sort of put my optimistic glasses on, I would say that since, you know, the pandemic happened, we now have greater embodied levels of knowledge and practitioners within online learning, because a bunch of people had to migrate to it with both feet, you know, not that long ago. So the knowledge level required to execute on those kind of changes has probably, you know, increased somewhat, you know, just by virtue of more people happen to have done it. So I really kind of think we're at a potentially really creative time. The conditions are there for individuals and groups and institutions to potentially kind of elevate their game or try new approaches, more bespoke approaches to individual cohorts, smaller, you know, online and in-person cohorts, again, leveraging the affordances of contemporary e-learning. So I think this is kind of a nice way to start to wind her down, because we're going on an hour here, bro.
Okay.
with this combo already, and I'm the one taking us on all the tangents. I just think, man, we could totally do a part two of this show.
We really could.
Yeah, man. So are we ready to kind of move on to the next reference here, pal?
I have one last reference, and sure. It's, I cherry-picked this sentence, because this is Siao and Tao, and they're talking about dialogic education and classroom teaching. But they had one sentence that was fantastic, and it summarized my thinking about structures and education structures and society structures. And it's like, it has related in a lack of coherence in the field with respect to what it is, how it should be implemented, and what consequences it has for students. And I'm like, yep, That's it. That is, I want to quote that.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner. Yes, sir.
So I didn't get into the dialogic education part, but they so nicely summarized where I was headed with this whole topic. It was like, yeah, we're kind of ignoring it. We're kind of going along to get along, but sometimes you end up in places you don't want to be and you know you shouldn't be. So then it's how do we make the change?
Well, I think, first of all, I really appreciate what you just said. But I think what we spoke to earlier about Socrates and the Socratic method, that's what I said, yes. Is actually dialogic, right? I mean, that whole, you know, not knowing, wanting to know, answering questions with more questions that lead you to, hopefully, the benefit, the creation of new actual actionable knowledge. So that is dialogic in nature, right? That is the Platonic sort of Socratic approach. So I think we did cover that a little bit, bro. And if not, I kind of horned her in. Philosophy minor for the win. All right, bro. So, yeah, it's all good. And now we got some pretty cool graphics.
Yeah, my digital
I like how I explain sailing to my guests. That's a good one, bro.
I have taught people how to sail. And I've had people on my boat when I had my boat. And everything comes down for me. I boil everything down to safety. If nobody gets hurt, it was a good sail. That's exactly how it works. It's if the wind's too strong and you're not comfortable, we don't go. If the wind's too light, we bob. Right? We just sit and bob. Let's go for a swim or let's dip our toes in the water. But it's all about here's how I explain it. I come down to where everything is, right? Like if you've ever seen the boom on a sailboat, that's the part that holds the big sail at the bottom.
Yep.
And it's called boom because that's the noise it makes when it hits your head. Right. So, yeah, don't do that. If you're going to pay attention to anything, never touch a line or a rope with bare hands. Right? Don't stand up without talking to me. Make sure that, right? It's all of those things for safety. And the structure of the boat and me being about safety determines where we head. And so I'm being an educator. I'm also taking them on adventure. I'm engaging with them and stuff, but it's all of this kind of things. And there's a bunch of stuff they don't need to know. Like the mainsail. It works like an airplane wing. It's technical. You won't understand. Right? But it works, right? Isn't that great? It's, or like wrap the line the other clockwise.
Right.
it's just those types of things. And I really loved this concept because here's the structure. We are all on this boat and here's what we're trying to do. And giving it that context helps make things more concrete in my brain. So,
right. Oh, man, that's a good metaphor. A very good, detailed metaphor.
And the only other picture, like there's some cool stuff in there that I really like. But there's one that I got years and years ago about the dreaming. And the dreaming
Sorry, bro. You've used this one before, have you not? I believe this is the second time I've seen this in the context of the show. It's awesome, and it's extremely awesome, and I'm glad. Maybe I could be wrong. Maybe it's just
you could be right, too.
But this is a awesome graphic, and I just horned in on your thing here, bro. But is what it is. So please continue.
But this is part of the infrastructure. Like when you're talking about traditional Aboriginal societies in Australia, this is what they're basing everything off of. Right? This is where they're coming from. And the people that wandered over to Australia thousands of years later didn't get it. And a lot of them still don't. And I'm not blaming anybody, but it's here's the basis for where we're going. And have we thought about that in our education structures? What really is the basis? Education used to be the structure for let's give it to young women to do before they got married. They can be teachers. And then they have that one old war vet that gets to be principal forever. And let's get all these factory workers, give them something for their kids to do, right? Like, it's like, what are we really doing here? So that's a bunch of bigger pictures.
Yeah.
And there's some others. So if you go to the website, analogtrope.com/podcast, they're all there. And I have the word question and the phrase of the podcast. And the word of the podcast is structure, because I was really struggling with structure, putting this together. And what was I really trying to get to? And hopefully we've figured that out.
Well, if not, we certainly explored a wicked problem, and we perhaps didn't whip the wickedness, but we extemporized and defined and certainly increased our comfort level with it. So I'd say mission almost accomplished. Definitely due to speak to this concept again.
Right on.
Right.
So the question of the podcast is, how can we adapt to the existing structures and best help learners? I think a lot of teachers are doing that now. Like, hey, we're stuck. We got to write that standardized test at the end of the year. Okay, so I'm going to teach them how to write a standardized test or how to prep them and all that sort of foolishness. But so those are the types of things. How can we adapt to the structures and limitations that we've got? The phrase of the podcast is Socrates was rocking it in the Agora.
Socrates was rocking it in the Agora. And the only thing I'm going to correct here is that needs a capital A, and you beat me to it. Live in the Google document, friends. I got it up in the other tab, and I was like, the only thing wrong with that is it needs a capital A. And literally, just as I was saying that, I saw Doug's little purple colored cursor in the live Google document switching that out. So this is episode 61, if you don't count the lectures or the interviews. If you count those, we're like, God, up to 70 or something of this. So it's starting to transcend, the cognitive, that's what I'm going to start saying, the cognitive aspects of this are starting to get like more naturally aligned. We almost got like our, between the technology aspects and just the process aspects, it's almost like we got our tools, but then we got our vernacular, right? Our operational language for using that. And God, the postmodern fun we could have that. Diderot and Foucault would be like off their rockers about it, friends.
Yes, indeed.
Word to your moms, we came to drop bombs. That's from House of Pain, and you didn't need to know that, but it's from their hit Jump Around in the early 90s, late 80s. And if I don't fill my coffee cup about here soon, I was about to try and rap the first couple of verses of Jump Around, but I don't think I want to subject Doug to that. The rest of you people, meh, you know, whatever, but I wouldn't want to do that to Doug. We're so close to the end. Have we got anything else we want to throw out here, Doug, before we wrap her up?
I don't. Thanks for putting this all together. Thanks for your patience with last week when I couldn't do it. And looking forward to the next one.
Yeah, there was a whole bunch of interviews that went up in the interim. So that was fine. That was very fine. And folks, we actually have at least one interview coming up this week. I'm not going to say the name just because I don't want to have to do a Camtasia edit after this thing is up if they happen to bail. But it's going to be lit. And it's at 6 p.m. Atlantic time, Doug, so you can probably do it. It's on Tuesday if you want. Anyway.
Cool. Sounds good.
Yeah. Folks, I've enjoyed it. Doug's enjoyed it. We both enjoyed it. We hope you've enjoyed it. Until next time, friends, take care. Bye for now.
Bye, everybody.